hospitals and clinics have special protections under international law, and the deliberate targeting of these facilities is a clear violation of these principles. As usual, the Israeli army first denied that it was behind the attack. Later, the regime and its Western allies, including the United States and Canada, claimed that the explosion was caused by an errant rocket fired by the armed group Palestinian Islamic Jihad. However, independent investigations by various media sources have debunked this propaganda. The New York Times conducted a thorough analysis of video footage from the night of October 17th, which clearly showed that the missile seen in the video, supposedly fired by Palestinian fighters, did not cause the explosion at the hospital. Instead, it detonated in the sky, approximately 2 miles away. It was, in fact, a missile fired by the Israeli military that caused a devastating explosion.
According to all feeds and videos analyzed, this rocket was intercepted and was the last one launched from Gaza before the bombing of the hospital. 5 seconds after that interception, an explosion in Gaza can be seen, followed 2 seconds later by a much larger explosion. This is the strike that hit Al-Ahli Arab Hospital. As a result, Al Jazeera digital investigations team found no grounds to the Israeli army claim that the strike on the Al-Ahli Arab Hospital in Gaza was caused by a failed rocket launch.
But Al-Ahli Hospital was not the last hospital targeted by the Israeli military during its onslaught. According to a report by Human Rights Watch in 2023, the Israeli military has repeatedly and unlawfully attacked medical facilities, personnel, and transport, further destroying Gaza's healthcare system. The report said these attacks should be investigated as war crimes, as they violated international humanitarian law.
Because every society has the right to have a healthcare system, and that's why the healthcare system is protected by the Geneva Convention. And the fourth Geneva Convention is utterly clear, has always been. And that's why these attacks on healthcare that are so well documented, and the most extreme, the most brutal examples are the situations like we have in Nasser Medical Complex now, where they're shooting and killing staff and patients inside. And the situation we had in the West Bank, where they again dressed up like doctors, fake doctors and relatives coming and hid their weapons and went into this room and shot and killed this patient who was actually immobilized, this Palestinian young man, and his two companions. Killed him, executed him and his two companions under the disguise of being medical personnel. The reason why this is so serious and why it is not stopped is so serious is that it threatens the immunity of the healthcare system and the safe network, the safety network that the healthcare system provides to people around the world.
On January 31st, an undercover Israeli death squad posing as Palestinians brazenly infiltrated a hospital in the occupied West Bank, resulting in the assassination of 3 Palestinians, one of whom was a partially paralyzed patient. Surveillance footage captured the alarming scene as approximately a dozen Israeli special forces raided Ibn Sina Hospital in the northern city of Jenin. Disguised as Palestinian medical personnel and civilian women, they brandished rifles while navigating through the corridors, perpetrating this shocking act in broad daylight. According to the World Health Organization, Israel has conducted nearly 400 attacks on healthcare facilities in the Gaza Strip, including on every single one of its hospitals, leaving the majority non-functional as of February 12. This illustration, published by the WHO, details the Israeli strikes on healthcare facilities in the Gaza Strip. According to the report by the World Health Organization, at least 659 people have lost their lives and more than 840 others injured in Israeli attacks as of February 12. Nearly 100 ambulances have been targeted, with more than 50 destroyed by the Israeli missiles. As of February 12, only 11 out of 36 hospitals in Gaza are partially functioning, 5 in the north and 6 in the south. According to the World Health Organization, hospital bed capacity across all of Gaza has now been reduced from 3,500 to just 1,400. But this is just the tip of the iceberg, and the disaster seems to be much worse. Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, is one of the international organizations actively working in Gaza despite Israeli attacks. Doctors Without Borders has already lost several staff members in recent months as a result of Israeli attacks. In the most recent attack, the Israeli military deliberately targeted an MSF shelter in Gaza, killing 2 people and wounding several others. As an international charity organization, MSF is committed to independence, neutrality, and impartiality, as it only seeks to provide medical services to vulnerable people across the world, especially those trapped in conflicts and war zones. According to MSF, the Israeli military systematically targets health facilities in Gaza. Médecins Sans Frontières deplores a situation in which people have been left with no options to go for treatment in case of a large influx of war-wounded patients. These systematic attacks against healthcare are unacceptable and must end now so that the wounded can get the care they need. The entire health system has been rendered inoperative. As a matter of fact, the targeting of hospitals in Gaza by the Israeli military has tragically become an everyday occurrence. Just recently, a harrowing voice message was sent by a Palestinian capturing the horrifying sounds of Israeli bombing echoing from Nasser Hospital in Rafah. The extent of attacks by the Israeli military leaves no doubt that the regime is deliberately and systematically targeting the medical centers in Gaza. Israel is now directly targeting medical staff in Gaza. But why is Israel destroying hospitals and deliberately targeting doctors and medical staff in Gaza?
Is that not only is Israel systematically targeting medical facilities, but they are targeting medical professionals. And Israel's objective in targeting medical professionals is to cripple the health sector by killing an entire generation of doctors, to the extent that building the hospitals after the genocide would not even suffice to restore the health sector. I mean, it's such an unspeakable thing, but this is all part of Israel's goal to make Gaza completely uninhabitable and compelling Palestinians to leave the Gaza Strip, which is one of Israel's ultimate war goals.
Such brazen attacks come amid the unequivocal support from Israel's staunch allies, including the United States and its European supporters, who have not only remained silent, but also supplied Israel with deadly weapons and ammunition to continue its genocide in Gaza.
My point is that it's horrible, and the most horrible thing about what is going on in Nasser Hospital now is that this has been going on for 4 months without no power stopping it. So, I don't know. I think the Israelis, with their impunity, they just keep going because no military force or political force or international alliance of decent nations are able to stop them. The only one who can stop them is the United States, and they don't want to stop them. They continue to supply them with political support and weapons. So this madness is a result of a deliberate politics, a deliberate policy from the United States, and unfortunately also from many of the European governments.
The United Nations has repeatedly condemned Israel's attacks on civilian targets, including hospitals in Gaza. In 2023, the UN Human Rights Council adopted a resolution that condemned Israel's attacks on hospitals and called for an independent investigation into the attacks. However, the resolution has not been implemented, as Israel enjoys impunity thanks to the unwavering support from its staunch ally, the United States, and other Western countries. The recent U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza has once again underscored the hypocrisy of those who claim to champion human rights and has highlighted the inefficacy of international organizations in addressing Israel's occupation regime.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islamite. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of Youth Station. Well, once more, I am honored to be here. And this is Asma. Well, I'm not alone. I have a co-host in here, Brother Mustafa.
Assalamu alaikum. So happy to be here. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's always happy to be in Youth Station. Well, one of the interesting part of the holy month of Ramadan is the gatherings that happen, the invitation of your friends, of neighbors, of whomever that is going to invite you for foods for the time when you're going to break your fasting. So it's very fascinating because of many reasons. Like, you're going to be gathered together, you're going to meet the people you haven't been able to meet for a long time. And then the food, of course, because they're going to be so creative in the kind of the food they're going to offer. And the entire concept of all of you going through the same thing and then breaking your fast together is an interesting thing. Like, to eat food together with your neighbors, with your family members, with your relatives is a recommended thing in our religion, which is going to happen in this holy month more and more.
And you know, the beauty is that you'll find that in different countries that and in different cultures, like, the practices vary, right? I've probably had, alhamdulillah, I've had the benefit of, you know, experiencing Ramadan in these 4 to 5 different countries, right? From Western countries to Arabic countries to now Iran and my own home country, which is Pakistan. You know, so I've seen, like, the different ways people are doing Ramadan, at least in these select countries.
So how is it in Pakistan?
So in Pakistan, so food is a big aspect of it. And unfortunately, I would say fried foods is a big part of our, you know,
meals or dishes.
Yeah, so you will see that, like, when we're breaking the fast, like, typically almost all the households that have similar dishes. For example, there's this
So again, the atmosphere is clear that everybody is fasting.
Yeah.
It's the holy month.
Yeah, the atmosphere is amazing, by the way, right? Like, you can feel it, like, among the people in the stores. Like, there's a really, really nice atmosphere. And in terms of, like, the foods that we have when we break our fast, there's this thing called pakoras. I don't know if you know.
Yeah.
Right? It's, like, made out of, it's made out of, like, this flour, and it has, like, spices in it and, like, you know, onions and stuff in it. And that's, like, a big dish, for example, you'll find.
But it's fried.
It's fried, unfortunately. Yeah. The healthier side to it is there's this thing called fruit chaat, which is just basically a mixed fruit. It's just, like, mixed fruits cut up together with some juice, you know. That's a big thing. Then there's, like, chickpeas, you know, they're cooked in a certain style. There's this drink called Ruh Afza. I don't know if you ever had it. It's like, have you ever been to a Pakistani's house for iftar?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, you should go
to somebody's house for iftar, I would say, you know. Fine. Do you have any Pakistani friends?
No, Indian, yes, but Pakistani, no.
Oh, okay. It's basically like a drink. I don't know why it's so popular.
So what is in that Ruh Afza?
It's something, it's similar to, like, I think you have something similar in Iran. It's basically, you know, you add some red
color? Like, is that color?
It's red colored, but it's really sweet. And it has a very
like a syrup.
It's a very specific syrup. That's right. So that's like one thing. I don't know. Do you have things like that in Iran, like specific dishes that are made for iftar?
The most specific one is zulbia bamiye, like the sweetie things. And I guess you have it too. The Indian people and the Pakistani people have it. Do they call it jalebi, I guess?
Jalebi, yeah.
Yeah. It's the same thing, but still. Ours is more beautiful.
Ours
more
is
delicious.
Unhealthier, actually. Okay. Ours is like full of like way more sweet than the Iranian ones. And then I would say in some of the Arab countries that I've been in, you know, even there, you really do feel it's Ramadan because they'll reduce like working hours.
Exactly.
Right. I remember when I was working there, like my hours would normally be, let's say, like from 9 to 5.
And they increase the number of gatherings.
Yeah.
And they gather together a lot. They invite each other for breaking their fastings.
Yes.
And they stay awake all the night, maybe together.
At least we can say.
I guess we can go for a break.
Okay.
Welcome back. This is Youth Station, and we're talking about the fascinating part of the holy month of Ramadan, which is going to be beneficial for every single individual in society, for those who are fasting and for those who are not fasting, for those who go for spiritual aspect and for those who go for non-spiritual aspects. And we're just technically talking about the gatherings that happen in this month. And also people are going to distribute foods to their neighbors. And to the poor people. That's also another interesting part in the holy month of Ramadan.
Yep. Like, you know, in Pakistan, the amount of free food that's distributed during Ramadan is probably like way more than the entire year, you know?
Really nice.
Yeah. You'll see like mosques and like, you know, just huge gatherings like out on the road of people like distributing food. And I know it's similar here in Iran, like, you know, you go to mosque and places, like people are distributing food and they're being charitable.
And that's so nice. It means that everybody is caring for the other person, for the other members of society who do not have enough of money or facilities to enjoy in this month.
And that's definitely part that God wants us to, right? The one of the reasons we get to experience hunger is to feel other people's hunger that are having hunger.
Like what they do in here is to create some packs, and they would take it to the poor people's houses, and they would distribute that, which is an interesting act.
Yeah. When we go to like our friends' houses on Eid, like the friends will also give like money to the kids, and then kids are just like sitting there counting how much money they've collected.
Yes,
I remember like, you know, I didn't get a lot of like pocket money or money like during when I was growing up, and. This would be like the biggest saving.
So you were
saving.
Counting on these occasions.
This would be the biggest saving of the year. You know, reading the Quran and like winning the competition at home, like finishing the Quran, my dad would give me like...
So it was a month of trade for you.
It is a month of trade. It's a month of trading with God, I would say.
Okay? Of course. Literally, spiritually.
Yeah. And then, it would be like the whole year, I would spend that eating.
Yeah.
Like that's how much money I would be able to collect. That was... So all these things that we're talking about, it's reminding me of all the positive things that Ramadan is, you know, throughout all the years since I've been a kid, of the positive impact that Ramadan's had on me and it's having on us. And now my own family, now that I have my own kids, I can see that as well.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's so beautiful for all the members of society. And just now that you mentioned kids, for them, it's a different story. Just as you mentioned it, they're going to have a lot of memories. These memories are going to turn into nostalgia. And then... they would collect money, of course. They would learn a lot of things from their parents, from the neighbors and everybody around. And these things are going to die deep in their wool. And then after they grow up, they would practice whatever they've learned.
Yeah. And one other beautiful thing that I really like about Iran and doing, you know, Ramadan here, is just the number of like lectures and different... You know, different religious lectures that are going on.
Yeah.
I mean, we have that back in Pakistan as well. We would have that. But over here, it's like it's like an explosion almost, mm-hmm. I would say. There's so many different options that you get to choose from in terms of Dars Akhlaqs and like the different scholars that are giving lectures. That I find really amazing here. That's something that I don't find anywhere else. Like the amount of dua programs that are here being held in Iran.
So we'd keep this point for the last part. Let's go for a break, and then I have something to mention about the point you already said.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So this is the last part of today's episode. I hope up until now you're enjoying what we're talking about. Since you mentioned the lectures that you're going through, I guess the programs that we have in television also is a good point to be mentioned. Like in television, there are many people who want to recite the Holy Book of Quran, but they either do not know, they're not educated enough to read it, or they're old people, or like even their kids, and they do not know how to read perfectly. So we have different, at different times, there are different recitation of the Holy Book of Quran in the TV. Yeah. We have some specialized programs for the holy month of Ramadan. Like even for those people who do not get to go out of home, there are lecturers who would talk about how to be perfectly in a good manner,
right.
How to treat other people in a good manner, like telling us about the narrations. All the programs in TV are planned to be in a way that spirituality is going to be prioritized.
You know, that reminds me of Ramadan serials as well.
Yeah.
That's a phenomenon I've noticed in almost every Muslim country, is that during Ramadan, there'll be some like special serials being shown, right?
Yeah.
And it's true in Iran as well that, you know, I just saw that, you know, there's some new serials coming out like this for Ramadan.
Yeah. So but this year, actually, everything is different for us in Iran because our new year is coming exactly in the holy month of Ramadan.
So Nowruz, right, is coming.
Some days later, I guess 7 or 8, is going to be the new year. And then we're just finishing 10 days of the holy month of Ramadan.
It's almost like two Eids for you guys.
Exactly,
right?
At the same time. They're coinciding.
Yeah. And I really like Nowruz and sort of like, you know, the Eid sort of, what do you call it, the traditions that are around Nowruz. And I'm happy that it is coinciding this year. You know,
exactly.
We can kind of get to do both at the same time.
Yeah. It's fascinating. And the number of the gatherings is going to be more and more this year.
Oh, so, you know, you're talking about those lectures on TV, and I was talking about that before the break, is that in Iran, you find there's a huge variety of those kind of lectures. And you know what's interesting is that going on throughout the day, like somebody was telling me there's one right now at Asr time, like around, I think, around 3 o'clock. I'll be sleeping during that time, I know for sure. But, you know, I'm surprised that they're happening at that time because there are people attending those, right? Or there's like Quran recitation at 3 o'clock, like from 3 to 4 p.m.
Yeah.
Right. So that's really amazing that people have that much willpower, that much energy. Oh, let me tell you one thing. So I go to karate classes right here. Well, I haven't been for a little while, but I've arranged karate classes for my kids, you know, through a coach. They want to continue having those karate classes during the fast, which is something that came as shocking to me.
Nothing would come in the middle of whatever they're doing.
Yeah, I was
nothing is an obstacle.
Like with this teacher, I was telling him, look, like, you know, so the class finishes right around Maghrib.
Yeah.
And I was like, what are you going to do about that? He's like, just tell the kids to bring something for iftar.
Yeah.
I was like, you know, like in our culture, that's not like very acceptable. Like people want to be at home or they want to be at a friend's home. But he's like, no, it's okay. It's like,
no, we had it. I actually had a class when I was about 18 years old or maybe 20, I had a class for an entire year. So it finished right at the time of the Maghrib, which was the breaking, which was the time for breaking our fasting. So just by then I came to home.
And then I had another teacher here who told me that he goes to play volleyball at like midnight, you know, like from 12 to like 2 o'clock.
Yeah.
I was like, how can you do that to yourself? But I guess that's...
They even have midnight classes.
Yeah, there's like midnight football going on. There's like midnight volleyball going on. People are having sports and
they're
classes.
They're attending their classes. They're getting to do their workouts. So everything is done normally.
Well, one last thing I want to mention is, of course, you know, we haven't mentioned in any of the episodes is the Knights of Qadr, the Knights of Power.
Of
you know,
course,
this is,
of course.
These are the Knights which God says that are better than 1,000 months. And that, I think, I found to be very similar across all countries, that people stay up at night, you know, whether they're Sunni or they're Shia, like
exactly.
you'll find that that's the common sort of practice among all of us, is that we stay up all night during those nights, those last 10 nights of Ramadan, and we spend those times in worship. And that's the culmination of all of everything that we've talked about. You know, I think they culminate on those nights. And God says those help decide for the rest of the year.
Exactly, right? Which are so important of nights. But then we don't have much of time to talk about that. So this was all. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. And go and research these nights if you want to.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. Because they have a lot of blessings and benedictions. And there are a lot of rituals and supplications to go through in these nights. So thank you for staying with us. Until another session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum. Wassalamu alaikum. Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Latif. Ya Allah. Ya Allah. Ya Allah.
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio, for those who seek the truth.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman, Allah, who is Al-Mannan. La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have a very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom and Islamic scholar, Sheikh Rouhani. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the concept of fasting or sawm. According to Islamic beliefs, in the holy month of Ramadan, the Muslims are obliged to fast for 30 continuous days. This fasting and sawm during the holy month of Ramadan has so many lessons for the people. Some of the dear listeners might not be familiar with these lessons and useful points of fasting of Muslims. Can you enumerate some of them for us?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The best or the most important virtue and merits of fasting is this, that it purifies, it cleans us from all the wrong things, bad things, evil things, sins. Because fasting means to control yourself, you know, to control your bad desires,
yes,
to control your bad wills, you know. This is fasting. So in the holy month of Ramadan, of course, when we practice not to drink, when we practice not to eat, it enables us to control other bad desires, other bad wishes and wills in the rest of the months and the whole year, to become able to enable ourselves to purify and to clean ourselves from all the bad things and wrong things in the whole year.
Yes.
So that's why it's a kind of practicing, you know. It is a, it's a practice that discover and unveil the hidden kind of capabilities of us, the hidden capacities of us, that we are able to very easily control ourselves. We are able to very easily improve ourselves. Just look at the holy month of Ramadan. When you cannot, when you stop eating, for example, for 30 days.
Yes.
When you stop drinking for 30 days. So eating and drinking is, it's something that seems very much difficult to stay away from it, you know. But in holy month of Ramadan, we understand that, no, it's not that difficult. We can do that. So then when it comes to the other kind of things, other kind of controlling, other kind of self-controls, it becomes very much easy for us that, of course, we can very easily perfect ourselves,
yes,
improve ourselves.
Okay.
Look like, for example, a student, if he wants to get, for example, the high marks, if he wants to be successful, he puts some limitations on himself.
Yes.
You know, or on or herself. The one who observes more limitations, more,
barriers and restrictions,
then he is the more successful.
Okay.
You know? That is why fasting, the one who fasts better than the others, he's more successful, he is more prosperous, he will get more rewards, and that rewards are also for he himself and she herself, not for Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is absolutely self-sufficient.
Yes.
He is in no need to our actions, our deeds, you know?
Yes.
All things that Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala provided us, for ourselves, like university. University tell us that, okay, you have to observe these things, and then finally you will get the best remark, or finally you would get the best diploma certificate, you know. So this diploma, this certificate that you will get at the end of your courses and the bachelor degree,
yes,
or the master degree or the PhD, then in the whole life you will be benefited by that.
That's,
it's not for the benefit of the university, it's for the benefit of you.
Mm-hmm.
Only the university provided you with these chances,
okay,
with these opportunities.
Yes.
Here the holy month of Ramadan is like an opportunity. Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala provided us with this, saying that if you observe these certain things,
yes,
you will be rewarded that things. So those rewards are for you, and this observing the certain rules are also again for you, because it purifies you, it,
yes,
cleans you,
mm-hmm,
it sometimes heal lots of diseases and let's,
okay,
say illnesses that nowadays says,
yes,
that by fasting we can control lots of kind of bad things in our body. Bodily also it's sometimes useful, even if that's bodily benefits were not there, again, since it's a kind of practicing by,
yes,
which we purify, we clean ourselves, it would be for the benefit of us.
Okay, that's right. And thirst and hunger are two important characteristics of the fasting for Muslims. From, we can say, early morning at dawn up to sunset, they have to fast for 30 continuous days. What are the major effects of these hunger and thirst for the Muslims?
So first of all, you know that when you observe certain, let's say, limitations or limitedness on you, if you have a good intention,
yes,
you know, if you had a good objective, if you had a good purpose for these limitations, that it would be enjoyable for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you enjoy.
Yes.
You know, like the one who is, for example, who fall in love with someone.
Yes.
You know, the more he or she wants to get closer to the beloved one, he observe lots of things, you know, to make the beloved one happy, to gain proximity to the beloved one.
Yes.
So those things that he observe, it is enjoyable. It is something like pleasure for him, like enjoyment for him or her. That is why this, let's say, limitedness or let's say these restrictions that sometimes we have, we face in the holy month of Ramadan, it should be enjoyable if it is with good intention. You know,
that's
sometimes
right.
you put some restrictions on yourself without any reason.
Yes.
Irrationally, you know, without reason. So, of course, that would be like a hardship, like difficulty, like will be really tiresomely, really botheringly, really bothersome, we can say. But if it is with good intention, of course, it would be enjoyable. It is not something that, what we can say, bothers you or annoys you, you know?
Yes, that's all right.
The month of Ramadan is more significantly about turning to myself. What have I done for myself? What am I going to achieve in this holy month of Ramadan?
يا نور الهلال أقبل تعال فالشوق طال.
A lot of you will find yourself saying, oh my God, I can't do this or say this because I'm fasting. Why can't you export that outside the month of Ramadan? This is why these 30 days are training grounds for us. They're springboards for us. And so we have to use these tools that we have in front of us to achieve that perfection, inshallah.
Who is hosting you? Get to know Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. As-sawmu li, there is a hadith Qudsi, as-sawmu li wa ana ujza bih. God says, fasting is for me and I am the reward of it. Some that read this hadith, wa ana ujzi bih, I reward for it, that's even good. And God, the generous, will not reward less than paradise. But here we can read it in a different way, that God says, I am the reward of it. يا شهر القرآن فيك أذوق حلاوة الإيمان لا لا تنقضي أنت للروح دواء رمضان
Still the main purpose of the holy month of Ramadan beside spiritual purification is the bodily purification, as you said too. This thirst and hunger will help the Muslims in order to somehow feel the hard and difficult situations of the hungry and the thirsty all around the world. But some etiquettes have to be observed too. For example, if we are fasting for 15 hours, we cannot make up for that from the time of iftar up to suhoor, you know. I mean, from the time of iftar also to suhoor, we have to be fasting somehow too. Maybe in terms of bodily one, we are not fasting, but spiritually we are still fasting, isn't it, Sheikh?
Yes, you know, fasting has different levels.
Yes.
Or layers, we can say. The one of this level is this, that you do not eat and do not drink. It doesn't mean that fasting is only not drinking and not eating. Because in the holy month of Ramadan, not only in the holy month of Ramadan, in the rest of the months as well, you have to fast by your eyes. You have to fast by your ears. You have to fast by your, for example, tongue. You have to fast by your mind, your brain, your mouth, your hands, your legs, your feet, everything. What does it mean? It means that you should not see and watch the haram things.
Yes.
You should not listen to haram things. You should not hear haram things. You should not say haram things, you know.
Yes.
You should not taste haram things.
That's why.
You should not go haram places. You should not, for example, do haram things with your hands, with your body. You should not think about haram things. You should not imagine haram things in your brain, in your mind, you know.
Yes.
The fasting has different levels. And the higher level of fasting, all these things that I mentioned, all of them should be observed. A true fasting Muslim is the one who observes all these things in the holy month of Ramadan.
Especially this holy month of Ramadan, we see the massacre and the genocide that is taking place in Israel and in Gaza Strips. You know, the Israeli and the Zionist regime attacks the people. So many innocent children are just after a piece of bread, a drop or a glass of pure water to drink. You know, this is really a hard, difficult situation. So this Ramadan for the Muslims must be very much different, Shaykh. I mean, just feeling the hardships and the difficulties that the children of Palestine are going through, I think must be felt by the Muslims too all around the world. At least sharing some of your food or money, or we can say charities with them.
You know, oppression is always bad.
Yes.
You know, it's not only for only Muslims. No, for Muslims, Jews, Christians, Hindus, Buddhists, even atheists, secular, let's say, whatever kind of characteristics you have, you know that oppression is bad.
Yes.
Killing innocent civilians, killing innocent kids, children, you know, men and women, old men and women. Innocent civilians, it is an oppression.
Yes.
Makes no difference whether it is performed by Zionist, non-Zionist, Muslim, non-Muslim, whatever. So that's why it is a new, it's a kind of universal value mm-hmm. in which all the people across the globe, from across the globe, believe in. That is why I think we have to know that self-controlling, one of the kind of self-controlling is that we should control ourselves not to commit oppression.
That's right.
Not to oppress the innocent people, particularly when it comes to these children, kids,
that's right.
innocent old men and women, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, oppressing on them is a major sin that we should not commit.
That's all right.
Particularly in this holy month of Ramadan.
That's all right. And we must know that fasting during Ramadan is not only for controlling, we can say, that's right, our stomach, our bellies, or something like that. If you are hungry and thirsty, of course there will be rewards, but the true fasting is about those people who all organs of their bodies are fasting, including their mind, their intellect, what's happening in their brain, you know. This is also a type of fasting for the people. And as I said, you know, you are hungry and you are thirsty, but at the time of iftar, you must also, when breaking your fast, you must also control your belly, control the food input, isn't it? At least try to be, that's right, generous during this month with helping the poor and helping the needy. And there are so many purposes behind the holy month of Ramadan. Thank you very much, Sheikh Rouhani. It was very kind of you. Nice elaboration on the concept of fasting during the holy month of Ramadan. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, please visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. لعلي وحسين وحسان إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسان لعلي وحسين وحسان كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week we evaluate a trending news story and we break it down from an Islamic perspective. With Muslims observing the holy month of Ramadan, many will be engaging in social activities with their brothers and sisters, including iftars, communal prayers, and events aimed at propagating Islam to non-Muslims. But in recent years, we've seen the Zionist lobby and its collaborators in the Muslim community propagating efforts that on the surface appear to be harmless interfaith events, but are actually attempts to normalize the Zionist regime to Muslims around the world. In this week's episode, we'll look at how these attempts are made and we'll explore what Muslims must do to remain alert to them. First, we take a look at some specific examples of the kind of individuals and organizations that are engaging in such normalization actions.
Interfaith denotes a harmony for all and elevates the idea of coexistence. However, in recent years, they have become vehicles for normalizing Zionism in the Muslim community. The peaceful multi-faith community building exercise has been hijacked by some in the hopes of weaponizing the goodwill between believers in the Abrahamic faiths. One such group is called Nisat Nashim, a Muslim and Jewish female-only network that engages in superficial-level discussions on religious matters in the hopes of utilizing the friendships formed under the banner of interfaith harmony and worship to silence criticism on Israel. In an event they held over preparations for the holy month of Ramadan and the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur, they repeated that we must celebrate what our similarities are and respect our differences. They later clarified that this statement was not regarding theological differences, but specifically in relation to the settler colonial Israel. However, this is not surprising, as the pro-Israel Board of Deputies of British Jews admits that it incubated Nisat Nashim for this purpose. Not only is this group funded by the Board of Deputies, but also by David Dangor, whose family also funds the Islamophobic Henry Jackson Society. Such infiltration requires Muslim accomplices. The co-founder of Nisat Nashim, Julie Siddiqui, is also the co-founder of the Big Iftar and works as a Muslim interfaith consultant for the Kosher Iftar, established at a pro-Israel synagogue. She has a long history of working with the British Armed Forces, which she has openly stated is something we should be proud of. Critics say that personalities like Siddiqui are the Muslim face of Zionism and hugely damage the value of interfaith work in multi-faith, multicultural societies like the UK.
Now, joining us on the show this week to discuss this extremely important topic are two very special guests. We are honoured to be joined by Reverend Dr. Stephen Sizer, the founder and director of Peacemaker Trust, a UK charity dedicated to peacemaking, especially where minorities are persecuted, where justice is denied and human rights are suppressed. Stephen is also chair of the Covenventia Alliance and the director of the Institute for the Study of Christian Zionism, as well as being a member of the executive of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. He's a retired Anglican priest, but continues to serve as chaplain to the former Bishop of Jerusalem, Bishop Riyah Abul Essel. We are also pleased to welcome a favourite of the show back, Sayyid Ammar Kazmi, who helps run the Left Legal Fighting Fund, a legal defence fund which focuses on assisting anti-racist, anti-fascist and anti-Zionist individuals and groups who need legal support. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to you both. Reverend Sizer, if I could start here with yourself, how would you define interfaith and what are the benefits of such dialogue and events?
Interfaith is about people of different faiths coming together to understand one another's background. It's not about proselytism. It's about complementing, collaborating on issues of common concern, whether it's poverty or racism, extremism, or in a case at the moment, Gaza. It's about listening rather than speaking. It's about empathizing, putting ourselves in the shoes of the other and finding what we have in common cause and then working together to ameliorate, whether it's natural disasters, human suffering, or extremism.
So then what would you say the Zionist movement seeks to achieve by engaging in interfaith, in what some have described as soft war strategy? Why are they spending time, effort, and money perhaps speaking to people who may oppose their ideology?
Well, we've just been describing what I would call authentic interfaith dialogue, where we treat one another as equals, respectful, and seeking to understand one another. The kind of interfaith dialogue that the Zionist movement engages in is very different. It's along the lines of, we set the agenda, and therefore you cannot criticize Israel. So it becomes a tool to suppress human rights, suppress challenging Israel's action. So, for example, in the UK, we have the Council of Christians and Jews, CCJ. But in reality, it's the Council of Christians for Jews. It never criticizes the Jewish community, never criticizes Israel. It's used as a means of suppressing Christian critiques of what Israel does.
And Ammar, if I could turn to yourself as well, and maybe first ask you the same question, that what does the Zionist movement seek to achieve by engaging in such interfaith? And also maybe touching on any personal experiences or professional experiences you've had when dealing with these types of events?
Well, as Reverend Sizer was quite eloquently explaining, you know, there's nothing wrong in principle with having interfaith dialogue. In fact, you know, particularly between the three Abrahamic faiths, I think there's been lots of interfaith dialogue and discussion over many centuries. This is not really something new. The issue is really in terms of how the Zionist movement and the state of Israel in particular seeks to weaponize this term interfaith and this idea of interfaith dialogue in order to serve its own interests, which really is has manifested itself in terms of infiltrating, you know, Muslim communities, trying to essentially get them on board with the idea of being friends with welcoming Zionists who are openly Zionists into their communities, into their mosques, breaking bread with them. And that has a kind of insidious effect because, you know, if you're talking with somebody and you're becoming friends with them and you're becoming friendly with them under the guise of interfaith, but really this person is trying to promote Zionism, it could help to compromise that individual, that Muslim or that Christian who's speaking to them in a very sort of soft way, because the next time that person sees atrocities happening in Gaza, in Palestine, or, you know, wants to criticize Israel in any way, perhaps they might think twice. They think, well, you know, I met this person and they seem to be pro-Israel. Maybe I don't want to offend them. I don't want to disturb these interfaith community relations we've developed. So this is actually one of the strategies. It's not necessarily just about open proselytism and saying, you know, you should defend Israel because of this, that, and the other. It's also about trying to compromise people through their relationships. And this is sort of the most insidious factor that the Zionist movement and the Zionist interfaith industry, has.
And it's almost like trying to disarm people, if you will, by default, really, as you mentioned there. Just staying with yourself, Ammar, what's the danger in the holy month of Ramadan in particular? Of course, at the moment, billions of Muslims around the world are observing Shahr Ramadan. What kind of events do you see the Zionists seeking to exploit? If you could expand on perhaps some of these types of strategies.
Well, there are a plethora of these interfaith organizations within Britain. And so during this holy month of Ramadan, of course, you know, I was just talking about breaking bread. This is the perfect opportunity to try to organize things like interfaith iftars, invite different sections of the Muslim community who may be completely unaware. This is the problem. There's a complete lack of curiosity, lack of skepticism, and indeed a naivety when it comes to this. And so, you know, you have Muslims and mosques being invited to these interfaith iftars and, you know, in a spirit of, you know, brotherly or community generosity. And so it's essentially a time in which the interfaith faith-washing industry is able to turbocharge its agenda within the Muslim community, because at this point in time, you know, Muslims are quite vulnerable in the sense that, you know, many Muslims begin becoming much more active in terms of their religious practice, in terms of their attendance at events, their attendance at mosques throughout the country during the holy month of Ramadan, and it's an opportune moment to take advantage of that, basically.
Thank you, Sayyid Ammar. Dr. Sizer, now, obviously you are an esteemed member of the Christian community and a reverend, of course, as well. Have you ever been maybe invited to or attended or, you know, been part of an event, and maybe it's become clear to you later on, hang on a minute, this may be, engaging with Zionists or something? Has that been something that people have tried to reach out and maybe pressure you to engage in?
Do you mean in terms of from a Zionist perspective?
Or? Yeah, like just in terms of, maybe some groups reaching out and saying, we want to do some interfaith, maybe before, your views on Zionism were perhaps as well-known as they were.
To be honest, no. I think most of the times I've engaged with Zionists, it's been in a situation where they've tried to challenge me or debate with me. So I've made several programs with Zionist TV stations, radio stations, where they've tried to trap me, tried to engage with me, but I think they gave up trying to win me from the very beginning. I think I've been involved in lots of interfaith events and opportunities, particularly with Jewish and Muslim friends, where we're genuinely trying to find areas of common ground that we can work together.
Yeah, and I think that's key. It's sincerity and genuinely engaging with people who aren't trying to use interfaith, which some actually prominent Zionists in the UK, for example, have openly said. We use interfaith as a way to make the case for Israel in a church or in a mosque and describe the kind of disarming tactics that Ammar was alluding to as well. Now, of course, Ayin Islam did speak to people in London to ask them their thoughts on the attempts being made across the world to normalize the existence of the Zionist entity in the name of interfaith.
I think that interfaith is a good thing. It's good to kind of get to know other faiths and what they're doing, and it builds those connections to start conversations. I think that we have to differentiate between kind of interfaith events and opportunities to network and connect, and almost creating that network to buffer down and silence a lot of our own opinions and a lot of our own viewpoints, with this idea that because we're kind of connected and friendly, it gives us kind of puts us in a bit more awkward situation position to kind of speak up about what we believe in. So I think that it's a good thing, but within our boundaries and with our kind of understanding of what we can talk about and what we can't.
Any multi-faith projects in that context would have been used as a kind of form of submission in the same way you might see it in geopolitics, where certain countries may say we're looking for forgiveness, peace, friendliness, etc., but ultimately it might be lending itself more towards submission or to acceptance of oppression. I think we shouldn't assume that they're normalization projects, for example. We should look at each case critically. And there are a lot of things that we don't want to politicize as Muslims, but ultimately, if our enemies, we know them, they are politicizing it, we should look out for those cases and be ready to treat those cases accordingly.
They're the sort of events where our point of view can generally be put across, where we're building up allies so that they can defend us in our times of need. And those are then those are, of course, positive events and positive things that we should do. But if there are events where it's just tokenism and it's just a whole bunch of chaps patting each other's backs and nothing actually being achieved in the long term, then I don't see what the point is.
Now, Reverend, if I could come back to yourself. We know that initially Zionism was an anti-Semitic, kind of evangelical Christian project, if you will, before it was a so-called Jewish one. Can you elaborate more on that?
Yes. At the end of the 18th century, Napoleon was at war with the British. French and the British were competing to control North Africa, the Middle East, and our trade routes to our colonies and other parts of the world. And Napoleon was the first world ruler in 2,000 years to promise the Jews a homeland in Palestine because he wanted the wealthy Jewish bankers to back his war effort against the British. So he set the price on Palestine. He was unable to deliver, but by the 1820s, British politicians were recognizing the need to secure the support of the Jewish community to help defeat the French and then eventually the Germans to control Palestine, because Palestine's the bridge, if you like, between the continents. So the race was on to control Palestine. So it was driven by some who were philo-Semitic, who genuinely loved the Jewish people and felt they should be returned to the land of their origins in fulfillment of Bible prophecy. But the anti-Semitic element was either implicit or explicit. Implicit in the sense that they were a tool of British colonialism. Mm. You know, the Balfour Declaration promised the Jews a homeland in the British Empire. It didn't promise them a state, didn't promise them independence. We weren't giving land away in the beginning of the 20th century. The explicit anti-Semites just wanted to get rid of the Jews out of Europe, out of Britain, and plant them in the Middle East. So the Zionist project, Christian involvement, preceded Jewish.